Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, August 10th, 2022. This is the 20th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I am joined by Phil Giraldi, a regular columnist to the newspaper and one of the top experts on U.S. foreign policy. Okay, Phil Giraldi, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you, John?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for joining me once again. You are, of course, one of the top foreign policy and geopolitical analysts in America, and you have contributed to American Free Press for a number of years. You also write for the UNS Review at UNS.com, and we just published issue 33 and 34 of American Free Press, which was mailed out on Monday to all print subscribers, and the PDF is available on the website at AmericanFreePress.net for anyone with a digital subscription. And of course, I would encourage our listeners to subscribe to the newspaper. One of the top stories in this most recent issue, of course, was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's very provocative and, in my view, entirely unnecessary trip to Taiwan last week. Now, this is an 82-year-old woman who has been in the House of Representatives for, I don't even know off the top of my head. It's been a couple decades, though. And she is easily one of the most corrupt and increasingly senile and reckless U.S. leaders I've seen in some time. And of course, I should mention that she is actually third in line to the presidency of the United States. And so, you know, her trip to Taiwan was a topic you wrote about in the current issue of the newspaper. And it's also something I know that you've been writing about at UNS.com. So to get started, can you kind of give us just your general reaction to Pelosi's visit? I'm trying to figure out what exactly she was attempting to accomplish with this, again, very provocative move.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the fact is that, you know, we elect government officials because we expect them to do positive things for the people who live in the United States. And here we have another case of a senior level official who should know better, going off on a provocation, which it clearly was, to send signals to China, which is the U.S.'s major trading partner, among other things, and basically to tell them that we would be sending the signal that we would be defending Taiwan if the Chinese were to seek to assert greater political control over it. The U.S. government long ago conceded that Taiwan is part of China, but there was kind of a secret agreement that the U.S. wouldn't press the issue of Taiwanese independence, and the Chinese would not press the issue of Taiwan rejoining the mainland China. So she clearly did not understand that. She went there and gave all the wrong signals, and there can only be trouble coming out of this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think more than anything, it was really designed to demonstrate power, to demonstrate that America is still in charge, that American exceptionalism still rules the day, no matter how hypocritical and absurd the situation is, like Pelosi, you know, visiting Taiwan and hearing what some of the things that she had to say, which I'll get into in just a moment. But I think really it was all about showing the world and showing China in particular that America still is number one and will do whatever it pleases to maintain its status as the world superpower. And see, what many people don't understand is that genuine American patriots do not actually control the U.S. government. America is ruled by a very hostile elite that is totally subservient to globalism and to Jewish power, frankly. And it's these forces that are actually using America, using the federal government and the U.S. taxpayer to basically advance their interests against the interests of the historic American nation and people. And to me, that's the number one signal with this trip. It's just another desperate attempt to sort of maintain this, you know, unipolar America-centric world order, which is becoming increasingly more and more discredited as each day passes. And it's sort of this joke. I mean, the people in China, the leaders in China, the leaders in Russia, and other countries around the world look at America as a total embarrassment. Frankly, it's an embarrassment to me as a U.S. citizen, seeing, you know, what passes for modern American politics. It's a total joke. And these people do not have our interests in mind at all. And Pelosi didn't even comment at all about how this was in America's interest to go to Taiwan. It was all about standing up for democracy against, you know, autocracy and totalitarianism and these sort of vague, ridiculous platitudes that are just increasingly worn out and tired and just hypocritical.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. That's exactly right. The elites in this country only have allegiance to other members of the elite. And that's our misfortune. It's bipartisan. In this case, one of the things to bear in mind is that we have elections coming up in a couple of months. And Pelosi was clearly sent on a mission by Biden, who, of course, is now denying that he authorized this trip, because they want the Democratic Party to look strong against a country that we are increasingly portraying as an enemy. And that's, to a large extent, what it's all about. This kind of talk is very popular among voters, among Republicans, and among the media. So the fact is, to a certain extent, it's a political ploy, which makes it even more disgusting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it definitely was a political ploy to show the American voting public that, look, you know, the Democrats are tough on China, and it's, you know, definitely meant to play into the election. I wanted to kind of talk about the history of U.S.-Chinese relations. And I follow a man named Warren Baylog on Telegram. He's one of the founding members of the National Justice Party and one of the most insightful political and historical commentators I've come across in a long time. And he posted something on Telegram, basically kind of given the background of the Nixon administration's negotiations with China back in 1972, which resulted in the Shanghai Communique, I believe is what it's referred to. Mm-hmm. And it basically explained China's position on Taiwan, and I'm quoting directly from it. It says, the Taiwan question is the crucial question obstructing the normalization of relations between China and the United States. The government of the People's Republic of China is the sole legal government of China. Taiwan is a province of China, which has long been returned to the motherland. So basically, China is affirming that Taiwan is a part of China. It's a province of China, which is ruled by the People's Republic, the Communist Party, essentially, and that there will not be any sort of two China policies. It's one China, and Taiwan is a part of China. And the U.S. affirmed this. The United States actually acknowledged that all Chinese on either side of the Taiwan Strait maintain there is but one China and that Taiwan is a part of China. The United States government does not challenge that position. It reaffirms its interests in a peaceful settlement of the Taiwan question by the Chinese themselves. And the Asia Times actually quoted somebody that was directly involved in these negotiations at the time, off the record, as basically saying that there's no other way to look at Pelosi's visit other than as a direct violation of the spirit of this, you know, very important agreement, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Joe Biden hasn't helped the case very much by, shall we say, misspeaking on three occasions and saying that the United States has an obligation to defend Taiwan, which is not true. So, you know, we have idiots on all sides here. But the fact is, this is like Ukraine. This is a confrontation that did not have to be. And she created this from nothing. And the fact is that there are conflicting territorial claims in the South China Sea involving a number of countries, but that is a separate issue. And they're trying to basically meld all the issues. Freedom of the seas is another rallying point. They're trying to meld all these issues to make China look like, as I said in my article, the over horizon upcoming major enemy of the United States. And there's just no reason for that kind of rhetoric.
Right. Yeah. We should be seeking to cooperate with the Chinese based on like mutual respect. Right. But that's not at all how America operates. And that's becoming increasingly more and more clear to the Chinese and to pretty much everybody else that's paying attention. Pelosi's comments, I wanted to read just a brief excerpt of some of the comments that she made when she arrived. She said, "Our congressional delegation's visit to Taiwan honors America's unwavering commitment to supporting Taiwan's vibrant democracy. America's solidarity with the 23 million people of Taiwan is more important today than ever as the world faces a choice between autocracy and democracy," which was clearly, you know, a dig at China. I mean, you know, I'm not one to really criticize the Chinese. I don't live there. I wish them the best. You know, however they want to, you know, run their country is really up to them. But I just don't understand the nerve of somebody like Pelosi to sort of denounce China as this autocracy when America is just this total tyranny at this point. I mean, it's a total joke. You know, the hypocrisy on display here. So we get these lectures from Pelosi, and it's got to be really, really aggravating the Chinese, I would imagine. I know there was sort of some sable rattling, you know, leading up to her visit, but since it doesn't seem like much has happened. I know there was like some military war games that were carried out by the Chinese military in the area. And I've also read that they did impose some economic sanctions. Do you know exactly how the Chinese government responded to this and you know, some of the steps that they've taken since Pelosi's visit?
Well, as you mentioned, there were war games. In fact, there's still continuing in a much reduced form, where warships and ballistic missiles and jet fighters were all scrambled and went through the usual things that happen in war games. They were playing out various scenarios, but I think the whole thing was a message back to Pelosi saying, look, we are taking what you are doing and what you are saying very seriously. You are basically, denying, agreements that were as the ones you cited, that were made, which basically said that Taiwan is part of China, and that China will not take steps to assert that control, while the United States will not take any steps to tip that balance in favor of turning Taiwan into a military ally, just as we're doing in Ukraine, surprisingly enough. So there's a pattern here. This is the rules-based international order that people like Biden and Kamala keep pushing, which is, of course, it's a myth. It's a device for American so-called values and American hegemony to continue to be dominant on the planet. And this is ridiculous. We're not there anymore. Well, China has a bigger economy than we have. China has outcompeted us in many economic sectors, aided by the House of Representatives and the Senate. And, you know, this is it's like a joke. You go and you do something awful, and then you make up some story to explain why you did it, and to make yourself look good and to make the poor victim look bad.
Yes, very well said. Well, China's foreign ministry was saying how it, you know, her visit seriously damaged peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, and that this is going to have a very severe impact on the political foundation of you know, U.S.-Chinese relations, which go back to that communique where it's explicitly stated that the United States recognizes Taiwan as a part of China, right? And they were basically saying that her visit infringes upon, China's sovereignty and territorial integrity, which it clearly does. And even just the way she frames her comments about, you know, how the United States is so committed to Taiwan's democracy. And, you know, they want to stand in solidarity with Taiwan against autocracy. I mean, even the way she frames it, it's like there are two Chinas. There's Taiwan, which the U.S. supports, and then there's China, which is this brutal autocracy that's oppressing Taiwan, and we need to stand up to them, right? I mean, even the way it's framed in her statements is sort of a violation of the one China policy.
Yeah, or it's ignorance on her part, but I can't believe she's that ignorant. She must have people on her staff who can explain things to her. And so it is a deliberate, it was a deliberate affront to China and China's government. And as I say, I think a lot of the timing has to do with politics, domestic politics in the United States. But it's also this kind of mindset that our foreign policy team, if you want to call them that, seems to have, which is that the United States sets the rules, tells everybody how to play, and that's the way it's going to go on forever. And it's just the United States doesn't have the resources to do this anymore in the first place, and it's always been a bad idea. It's meant that we support regimes that are brutal, like the Israelis, who attack Gaza and kill 15 children, while we are complaining because the Russians allegedly are attacking civilians in Ukraine. I mean, there's so much hypocrisy in the U.S. government, the positions that it stakes out as a result of this mindset. I don't know how else to call it. It's just going to make trouble for Americans. It's going to tax us to death. It's going to take away our, another issue is obviously our fundamental liberties. I mean, there's a, you know, the disinformation czar in the U.S. government, to say that what you and I are talking about right now is disinformation. I mean, what is happening to this country?
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. When I hear people like Pelosi lecture the Chinese, she actually, there was an opinion piece that she released in the Washington Post. I think it was right after she landed or shortly before, where she was, again, basically condemning the Communist Party in China, saying how it's threatening Taiwan's democracy and these sorts of, you know, these sorts of platitudes. She talked about China's brutal crackdown on political dissent. Meanwhile, we have the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI are literally criminalizing any sort of political dissent. I mean, it's, you know, the hypocrisy is just so in your face. And just absurd. I mean, we have a totally politicized justice system where conservatives and political dissidents, you know, American, you know, sort of pro-American political dissidents anyways, are targeted by the regime. And left-wing fanatics, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, minorities in general can basically do whatever they want. I mean, the rules and the laws do not apply to these people. So again, it's just total hypocrisy on the part of Pelosi and the United States government in general. And it's just totally, again, totally unnecessary. Just like the situation in Ukraine, the conflict in Ukraine was totally unnecessary. And yet the United States government continues to double down and pursue these boneheaded policies that are totally contrary to the interests of the American people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, as I said in my first comments, you know, the reason why we have government, why any society develops a government, is for the government to be able to act collectively and to do things that benefit the people. And boy, we're so far away from that. I mean, I would say the tripping point was 9/11 and the various pieces of legislation that were passed after that, which basically were will allow the government to imprison people forever. There are five prisoners still in Guantanamo that have been accused of being involved in 9/11, but the government doesn't have actually any evidence to demonstrate that they did anything, and so they sit there in prison. They've been there for 20 years. So, I mean, this is, what kind of government does this? How does this government get sanctimonious about what it does and how it does it, based on its own actions?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, the Russian Foreign Ministry obviously considered Pelosi's visit a clear provocation, which is keeping with the United States' aggressive policy of comprehensive containment of China. That's basically what they said. And this is so clear. I mean, U.S. foreign policy seems to be primarily directed at sabotaging and undermining competitors to this sort of, you know, unipolar America-centric world order. There was that meeting in early February, I think it was February 4th during the Olympics, between Russia and China, where in the aftermath, both countries affirmed their commitment to working together. They already had a very strong relationship, obviously. But following this meeting in early February, this commitment, this you know, working relationship was renewed and sort of doubled down upon. And they argued that they were entering a new era of international relations based on trust, mutual respect, economic and political cooperation, and respect of the sovereignty and uniqueness of individual nations, international legal norms, the United Nations, and this sort of troubled me, sustainable global development. I'm not a big fan of that. But that's sort of what they committed to. And it clearly was a break from the unipolar America-centric form of international relations that has prevailed largely since World War II. Do you think this explains much of the hostility towards China and Russia? I mean, they seem to be clearly wanting to break free from this death grip that America has on the world.
Yeah, I think that explains a lot of it. And I would elaborate on that, saying that the new Silk Road that the Chinese are constructing is a whole new economic model for much of the world. I mean, it's going to tie Eurasia together with Europe. It's going to ultimately require abandoning the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency and replacing it with some formula which presumably will be more inclusive. And so the result is, you know, that I think when they talk about threat from China, the threat is an economic threat. It's a threat of a competitor which is doing things that undermine your supremacy. Now, whether that is a good reason to go to war or not, and I would say no, that maybe the better thing to do would be kind of to fix our system. It's just an appalling prospect that we have people like Nancy Pelosi, who, by the way, has no actual foreign policy role. I mean, the Congress sends out CODELs to various places in the world just to observe and gather information. But she has no role to play as someone to go to a place like Taiwan and come out with what is essentially policy.
Right, yeah. Well, you had mentioned, and in the article you actually bring up sort of like the Biden administration's stance towards China and Russia, and you quoted Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who characterized the strategic partnership between China and Russia as basically an attempt to undercut the rules-based international order that run counter to our values and interests. And shortly thereafter, NATO actually basically made similar comments, talking about how this, you know, growing, this budding relationship and strategic partnership between China and Russia is basically the number one threat facing the alliance. You have a quote here from Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, where he characterized China as basically building up its military forces, including nuclear weapons, bullying its neighbors, threatening Taiwan, monitoring and controlling its own citizens through advanced technology, and spreading Russian lies and disinformation. And then there was also a NATO-issued strategic concept document basically outlining all of this once again and arguing that China poses a systemic challenge to the alliance. Now, wasn't NATO formed to, you know, counter the Soviet Union? What business does NATO have dealing with China? That's one thing that doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it hasn't made any sense for a long time now. I mean, NATO was founded in 1949, and its founding document basically was that it's the intention of having a military, defensive military alliance was to counter the growing communist influence in Eastern Europe and the establishment of communist regimes in those countries. So that's what it, its original purpose was. But we find in the 1990s that NATO was suddenly involved in a civil war in Europe, in the Balkans, in Kosovo, which did not fit in that formula. We have NATO getting involved in the destruction of the stable regime in Libya. We have NATO getting involved in the U.S. Adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this has been, this role has been expanding under pressure from the United States. I talked to a fair number of Europeans, and I don't detect much enthusiasm for this agenda, this NATO agenda, this American-driven NATO agenda among Europeans. And I think this is when we talk about how the government of the United States has betrayed the people. A lot of governments in Europe are betraying their people also.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that sort of sentiment is very prevalent here in the United States now, you know, as a result of this situation in Ukraine where inflation is rising, you know, there's food shortages, diaper shortages, food form, baby, you know, baby formula shortages, all sorts of problems facing the country. And yet we have billions of dollars to continue to dump into Ukraine. Who knows where the money is even going? You know, I've seen reports that some of this weaponry that we're sending over there, 70% of it doesn't even make it to the front lines. It's, you know, either stolen or sold on the black market or, you know, confiscated by, you know, private criminal gangs. I mean, the whole thing is just a total disaster. And yet the United States government continues to double down on these sorts of policies. I think I read just the other day there's another $1 billion in military assistance going to Ukraine to, you know, fight in this totally unwinnable war. I mean, there's no way that Ukraine is ever going to prevail in this conflict. And it's just a total tragedy. And yet, you know, the United States, the EU, NATO continue to double down on these totally reckless and dangerous and again, unnecessary policies.
Yeah, well, one of the articles I wrote recently was basically demanding that for the first time, certainly the last 20 years, we should establish accountability among all these people that make these decisions. And basically the decisions are bad. They've been produced bad results for the American people. We've spent, what is it, $8 trillion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and various other places. And we've killed by directly or indirectly something like a million people around the world. I mean, you know, this stuff is just, it's incredible. You don't get the media talking about this kind of thing. And yet here we are jumping into another adventure. One of the things that amused me in a sad way was that Biden a couple of weeks ago signed a bill for $1.9 billion to go to Ukraine for health care. Now, you know, the United States has experienced a health care crisis caused by mismanagement and corruption. And so we send $1.9 billion to Ukraine, where it's inevitably going to go into somebody's pocket.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the that's basically the story of Ukraine. It just is this dumping ground of U.S. money to, you know, pay off all these corrupt politicians. And a lot of it gets sent back, you know, sort of washed back into the pockets of corrupt officials here in America and in Europe. It's just totally out of control. And yet, you know, we continue to have the Biden administration, NATO, European countries. I know you also quoted, I think it was the FBI and MI5, Britain's intelligence agency, basically. They came out and released a report saying that China poses the greatest threat to the West, essentially. And it's amazing. You have to turn to, at least in my opinion, I often find myself having to turn to Russian political figures and Chinese political figures to actually get the truth of the situation and to get a proper understanding of what's actually happening. You have a good quote from a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman who basically said that facts have proven that it isn't China that poses a systemic challenge to NATO. It is NATO that brings a looming systemic challenge to world peace and security. 30 years after the end of the Cold War, NATO has not yet abandoned its thinking and practice of creating enemies. It is NATO that is creating problems around the world. And that is so obviously true with all the wars you just mentioned. You know, ever since 9/11, NATO has been, you know, basically led by the United States. NATO has been used to invade and occupy and destroy countless countries in the Middle East. You know, all basically at the behest of this, you know, sort of globalist Zionist project in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. The American foreign policy, in a lot of respects, is run out of Jerusalem. And that has had unfortunate consequences for the United States. It means we got involved in places like Iraq, where there was no logical reason to get involved, and a whole slew of lies were created by the neocons who were at the Pentagon and in the White House to sustain this this argument. And this has been an ongoing process. And I just, you know, I don't understand why people can't wake up to the fact that that our government is so corrupt, and we are so manipulated, and we are so much in the pockets of oligarchs of various kinds. You know, this has to stop, or this country will cease to exist.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well, I mean, I totally agree with you, obviously, and it's becoming very, very obvious, you know, what is going on. It's not a secret. I mean, it doesn't take much to kind of see, you know, to kind of see through the propaganda and the lies and the spin. And one final topic I wanted to bring up before we wrap up. You wrote an article about a month ago titled, very, very provocatively titled, "How Jewish is the War Against Russia?" And, you know, you sort of go through and enlist, you know, the basically the key people involved in promoting this sort of U.S. foreign policy, this very anti-Russian U.S. foreign policy. And it sort of ties in to what happened during 9/11, after 9/11, the neocon-driven foreign policy in the Middle East. And I know it's gotten you in a lot of trouble over the years. It's gotten me in a lot of trouble over the years just talking about these sorts of things. But you can literally quote these people in their own publications where they basically boast and brag about it. And yet it's condemned as some sort of like hateful anti-Semitic conspiracy theory when you simply point it out. I know back in the day you were actually, and you comment on this in the article, you talk about how you were fired from the American Conservative magazine where you wrote for years for basically pointing out the role that Jewish neocons have played and continue to play in driving and promoting America's wars in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, Jewish power in the United States is quite astonishing. I mean, wherever you look, universities, the professions, in politics, and even at state and local levels of government, you will find this thread running through and through and through. And it is something that Jews find very offensive to mention, although they brag about it among themselves, as you have observed. And it largely comes from money. If you want a newspaper to say good things about Israel, you buy it, or you threaten not to advertise in it. If you want to buy a politician, you go and you give him donations. If a politician balks at the Israeli and Jewish control that's exerted over our system, he or she will find next time around a really good candidate and really well funded being run against him or her to get him or her out of the system. So this goes on over and over and over again, and it means that people are essentially terrified of talking about Jewish power and the impact it has on our country. I'm not afraid to do that.
Yeah, I'm not either. And in fact, I think it's probably the most important topic to address and to openly discuss if we want to figure out what the heck is going on and who's responsible. But again, it's one of the most taboo topics in society, but it's the most critical topic for actually understanding what is going on. And all one has to do is look at the Biden administration to understand the reality of Jewish power in this country. I mean, virtually all of the top positions in his administration are staffed by individuals that are openly Jewish. And you see the sorts of policies that they champion, whether it's Anthony Blinken at the State Department, or Merrick Garland at the Department of Justice, or the Jews running the CIA and the intelligence agencies, or any other cabinet position in the government. And then, of course, we all know about their power and influence in the mass media and the way they can shape narratives and spread lies and propaganda and basically prevent anybody from openly discussing these sorts of things. It's incredible. And again, it's the most important topic if you want to understand what's really going on in this country.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree. I mean, when you consider that the four top people in the State Department are all Jews, and that one of them was Victoria Nuland, who arranged for the problems we're experiencing vis-a-vis Ukraine back in 2014 when she led the effort to overthrow the existing government that was perceived as being pro-Russian. So they're into it. The U.S. would never be involved in Syria if it weren't for Jewish power. It would not be running the most hostile 50-year conflict with Iran if it weren't for Jewish power in Israel. You can count the wars. Again, get back to Libya. We get back to Iraq. You know, it's over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I want to wrap up really quick with one last comment. Do you see, we sort of talked about this emerging Russia-China alliance and, the BRICS alliance, for example, and sort of these like emerging alternatives to this U.S.-centric world order. And of course, the NATO, the United States, the EU. I mean, these structures are basically totally dominated by Jewish power and influence. Do you see this alternative, this emerging, Russia, China-led world order as being under their influence as well? Or do you see it as sort of like a genuine alternative to what has sort of dominated international relations for so long?
I see it as a genuine alternative. I think that the United States has so overstepped any kind of decent red line in terms of its own activities and actions that there is a consensus throughout the second and third world, if you want to put it that way, that this has to change. There has to be fundamental change, and in particular, the change has to be seen in economic and currency exchange situations. I mean, right now, in terms of Venezuela, in terms of Russia, in terms of China on occasion, the United States, they put dollars in U.S. banks, and the United States government can freeze that money. And we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars. This is theft. And I think the world is tired of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Russia has basically called it that and, is just openly calling for, for a third way, for a different way of dealing with the West in general. And I think that is long overdue. And I guess we'll see in the future how genuine of an opposition it actually is. I tend to agree with you. I think it is a genuine alliance, a genuinely separate path than what we've seen in the past. So time will tell if we're right, though. We'll see what happens. But I mean, I think I just don't see how the United States can continue to carry on in the manner that we have for the past 50 or 60 years or so. It's just unsustainable, frankly, and we're seeing that play out in real time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is like the lemmings, pouring over the cliff into the sea. That's when you look at our government, you look at the nonsense they come out with. I mean, even this thing about the search of Donald Trump's residence, I mean, come on. Joe Biden is denying that he knew anything about it. Can you even imagine that they would do something like this without at least briefing him that this would be coming, given its political implications? I mean, it's a lie after lie after lie.
Yes, sir. Well, Phil, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work. And once again, I would encourage everybody to check out AmericanFreePress.net.